This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this month, Governor Phil Scott revealed his proposal for the state budget. Much of the assumption about how much money the state has to spend is dependent upon an expected amount of money that comes from the federal government. But after Scott's budget address, when we invited the House and Senate Appropriations Committee chairs to share their reactions, Representative Kitty Toll said we shouldn't be so sure that we're going to get what we expect from the feds.
We have a total state budget that last year that was passed at $5.7 billion. And of that, 35% of the budget is federally funded. And of that 35%, $1 billion is Medicaid and $400 million is human services. And so if there's loss of federal funds coupled with, if there are major changes in state funds, we could have an entire service that is at risk for Vermonters. And I didn't hear any plan of what we do with the loss of federal funding. And it's very difficult to plan for the unknown, but it's something that we have to keep our eye on because it could have a devastating impact on a state like Vermont that relies so heavily on federal funding.
And Vermont does rely heavily on federal funding. We are a net importer of federal money, and programs large and small rely on this money to stay solvent. We wanted to get a better grip on how that federal money gets allocated and where it goes, and to see if there's any clarity on where cuts might come from with the new administration and Congress in Washington. And I'm joined today now for this conversation by Finance Commissioner Andy Pulido, who's going to help us run the numbers. Commissioner Pulido, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You heard Kitty Toll there talking about the overall budget for the state of Vermont, more than $5 billion, and she said 35% of that comes from the federal government. So can you drill down a little bit on those numbers for us?
Right. So Representative Toll is correct. Our total state budget is about $5.7 billion. So for purposes of this conversation, we're going to round the numbers a little bit because they're so big. But $5.7 billion, there's two figures that are thrown around customarily when we talk about the state budget. One is the total unduplicated budget, which is 5.7. There's a second number, which is closer to $8 billion. That includes some federal money running through the budget twice. So it is $5.7 billion. Of that, about $2.2 billion is federal money. So it is about 35%. And it's spread across pretty much every department and state agency, even things like the Department of Corrections, which are historically 100% general fund. There are some federal funds that even flow into a department such as that.
Like what? So what flows into corrections? You are the former corrections commissioner, so this is an area of expertise for you.
Well, so there's things that go into help. So Medicaid funding, which is a global commitment actually, that goes into help transitional housing. There's substance abuse programs historically have had one-off grants. There's money to help with sex offender reentry. And so there is a lot of federal money all across the state. And when we run the list of granting agencies, so we run it by grant, federal grant, it's 4.5 pages. And it's the long pages, not the short 8x7, 8x11 or whatever it is. I guess it's 11x14. It's 4.5 pages and it's every department and state agency and a lot of the not-for-profits in the state and otherwise hospitals. There's federal money all over the place.
Yeah, and your expertise is in government and where the money is coming in and flowing through the state government. But, of course, there are so many other areas where there is federal money, and we may not have complete tallies on that. But, listeners, you can weigh in as well and share if you are part of an arts organization that gets federal money or a science or research institution or organization. VPR gets about 8 or 9% of its funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Right. That is federal money flowing through into us. Land grant colleges, so many places where federal money comes into play here in the state of Vermont. And listeners, if you have a question about this or you'd like to share a thought or a comment on federal funds, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We heard there that a huge part of the Agency of Human Services budget comes from federal funds, and a lot of that is into health care. What are some other big ones, Commissioner Pulido?
So Medicaid is probably the biggest, and Medicaid pays for a lot of things other than health care. It obviously pays for front-end care for a certain segment of the population, which, by the way, is a big population. It's 170,000–180,000 Vermonters. But then there's also money that goes into the Women, Infants, and Children's Program, which supplies food directly to recipients, food stamps, you know, transitional housing, like I mentioned already. But then there's other housing. There's homelessness housing. So there's federal money that runs into that. There's money for mental health treatment. There's money to support historically the state hospital, money to support historically Woodside, which is services for
– That's juvenile rehabilitation.
Correct. That's correct. And so all the populations that AHS serves, which is a lot of people – get some federal money. Then the Vermont Department of Health, which serves all Vermonters because they have programs that do food safety, dentists, for instance, dentist certification. There's federal money that runs through the health department that will affect all of us. There's radon grants, water testing grants. There's all those things that combine to equal the AHS budget, which is just a portion of this. So AHS's total budget's about $2 billion of the state's 5.7. It's a little more than $2 billion. And more than half of that is federal money. So it's a lot of – I think the total state money that goes in the AHS, I'm going off memory here, is about $600 million. So the rest of it's all state money. And obviously AHS has a pretty complicated mission between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Health. Completely different missions but affecting almost all Vermonters. Department of Corrections, back to my old world – affects the safety of every community in the state. So it's in a lot of different ways.
And then – so that's AHS. And then we can look at a few other buckets. And as you said, federal money flows through almost every program and every agency and every department. But something like VTrans, the Agency of Transportation, how much federal funding is coming in?
So I think there's about $300 million that goes into VTrans to support – roads, and I'm going off memory. I might be off on that one a little bit, but it's hundreds of millions of dollars that goes into support roads, bridges, and so on and so forth. Even something like the Department of Public Safety. Oftentimes, the Department of Public Safety will access a one-time grant to go out and buy something to support the work that public safety does. So there's a lot of individualized grants. I remember a number of years ago watching the chief of police in Burlington in front of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee asking for money to buy bulletproof vests, I think it was. One-off grant goes into the safety of officers all around the state. So there's the big entitlement grants like Medicaid where somebody goes in for a doctor visit, they meet the criteria, we send the state money and it matches with federal money at a match rate and pays the doctor or the hospital. And then there's all these other series of one-time grants, or some of them could be continuing, but they're done in like a yearly basis, for instance.
We did a show recently on waterways cleanup and the really big price tag, and we're talking in $1 billion, more than $1 billion, to clean up Lake Champlain and other waterways. And a lot – I mean that plan is still a proposal. State Treasurer Beth Pierce has submitted a proposal. The governor said in his budget address, thanks for that. I think we can do it without charging fees or creating new taxes, but it remains to be seen what his proposal is and what actually comes out of it. Needless to say, in any of the plans that are being thought of, there's a lot of federal money there too for lake cleanup and environmental concerns.
And I think in his mind, he'd like to see – so there is money in the first 2 years that goes into lake cleanup. He'd like to see, one, if there's any rethinking of how that proposal comes together, so the billion-dollar price tag that you mentioned. And then also – give it time to see if the initial investments that we're making as a state, and they're in the order of magnitude of $30 to $60 million, if they're substantial, do they have the measurable effect that we hope they'll have? And so I think his approach, in my opinion, is just to go a little slower to see how this shapes up, do some things and see if they meet the outcome, and then see if there's any rethinking on the behalf of the feds to see if maybe there's some middle ground on this. So it's not the full $1 billion, because it is a big price tag.
Well, and luckily we don't have to adjudicate that plan today on the program. We got a note from Mike in Cornwall who wanted to know, is the federal money part of the $5+ billion state budget? And the answer to that is yes.
Correct, yes.
And then Mike also says, does Vermont receive more money from the federal government than it sends in taxes or vice versa?
And that's the $2 that you mentioned where for every dollar we send – and there's a lot of studies that look at this. So there's a lot of different groups that look at how much money we send. But in The best study is the one that you quoted, which shows that every dollar that Vermont sends into the feds, we get $2 back in support. There's states on the other side of that. There's states much higher than we are.
Mm-hmm. So, Mississippi, I think, is the top. Mississippi right. gets about $4.70.
So double, right. So, and a lot of that has to do with entitlements, population, poverty, match rates. We get a lot of our match rates driven off of the small state minimums. A state like Mississippi is much, much bigger than we are, much bigger population. So California, where they have big populations and different issues than we face, they access a different level of federal grants. But a state like New Jersey is less than 50 cents on the dollar, I think it is. So it varies greatly. I think we're like in the top 20-ish.
Yeah, maybe even in the top 15 here. I'm looking this is from Mises.org, and we right. will try to tweet out a link to that or put it up on our page if you're curious to see how Vermont stacks up. But the bottom line there, Mike, is that it looks like Vermont gets about $2 in federal aid for every $1 we send to the federal government in the form of taxes. We're talking today about federal funding and how Vermont gets it, how much we get, where it comes from. A little bit later, we'll be talking about some of the questions that remain about what might happen to cuts. If you have a question, our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. But again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. Kate is on the line from Williamstown. Hi, Kate. Go right ahead. Hey, Kate, you there?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
No, I just had a question. It probably wouldn't happen, but if they take away our federal funds, do we have to pay federal tax? And I understand they pay $2 for every one that we send to Washington.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So Commissioner Pulido, Kate asks if the money coming into the state of Vermont is cut, can we cut what we send to the federal government in taxes?
That's probably a very good legal question. I don't think we can. They're completely different mechanisms. So there's federal tax code, and then there's the mechanism to grant them back out through the granting agency. I think they are detached.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing in terms of them cutting the money that comes in, at this point, there's a lot of conversation, a lot of media, but at this point, we are of the opinion that we're on pretty good legal standing, that we are okay for now. Now, how things shape up, it's still early. We're less than 2 weeks from the federal inauguration. So how things shape up over the next few months still remains to be seen, I think.
Well, that's a curious part of this, Commissioner Pulido, because obviously the state of Vermont is making its budget
right.
based on certain assumptions. But we're creating and finalizing our budget before we know what the federal budget is.
So we do that every year. To the extent we haven't had a federal budget in – I don't even remember when the last one was. We keep living on continuing resolutions. There's always a little bit of uncertainty. The state has taken steps, however, to protect against some of that uncertainty. Obviously, if it's really wide sweeping, that'll be a different story. But, you know, we have a 5% reserve in our general fund, education fund, and transportation fund. And all of those three are completely funded. In this governor's budget proposal, too, it continues that funding. So that's one source.
Meaning that if the federal government cut funding, we have a little bit of a buffer
right.
built in. And that's not rainy day funds. That's just built
that's
into
right.
the
so
budget.
So you have the 5% across the board. Then there is a rainy day fund, which is about $6.8 million. We keep carrying that year to year as a kind of a guard against uncertainty, not only anything the feds do, but also caseloads or whatnot. And then – in the governor's submitted BAA, Budget Adjustment Act, he set aside $10 million into a caseload reserve. As things started to shape up at the federal level in the 2018 budget proposal, he proposed changing the name to Federal Contingency and Caseload Reserve. And we are proposing to put another for total after both acts, $32 million. So there is some reserve against any uncertainty. And then there's another funding source within AHS that reserves $86 million against AHS caseload. So there are some reserves. Those will be depleted very quickly if there's wide sweeping action. But at this point, it's
that's
hard
not
to
what
kinda,
you
it's
expect.
To, yeah, right.
Well, we got a note from John who says, if worse comes to worst in regards to our relatively recently acquired habit of getting more than our share of the national pot, it seems like as Vermonters, we should be able to buck up and adjust. if we somehow went to a system where what we send to the federal government is exactly what we get back, that sounds to me, if I'm calculating right, like our federal funding would be cut in half. Could the state withstand that?
Not without wide sweeping program changes. So you would wind up, using that math, cutting our $2.2 billion to $1.1 billion, right? So half of that is tied up in the Medicaid program at least.
Well, and on that, SLV says one of my greatest concerns is enthusiasm from the Republican Congress to block grant Medicaid and other key social service programs. Even a 5% or 10% cut in Medicaid would be devastating to the state budget, and the people who depend on these programs would be left high and dry as resulting cuts would be made.
That's
is that
right.
accurate?
So if you think about a 5% cut in that grant, you're talking about $100 million. Or $100 million in the federal grant. If you talk about a 5% cut in the Medicaid, you're talking $50 million or more. That's tough to spin that around in a short period of time. So that's what the contingency reserve is designed for, is a little bit of an immediate buffer. Then as we see how the budget shape up long term, if that was a permanent cut going forward, there is programmatic changes that will need to be made with legislative action, I believe, in order to accommodate that.
Jerry's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Jerry. Go right ahead.
Hey.
Hi.
This is a question for Commissioner Pulido. There are two situations where Vermont may actually owe the federal government some money that it received. The first one I'm sure you're aware of, the Medicaid Reserve Program, which was described by Peter Shumlin in his farewell address. He referred to it as a $100 million reserve fund, but in reality, it represents extra money that the federal government gave the state of Vermont over and above what the state needed to fund its Medicaid program. And a specific question I'll have is, do you think that's going to be returned? And the second one, with regard to Vermont Health Connect, the Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services has said that Vermont overbilled the federal government by about $10 million for setting up that program, and the Inspector General says that money should be returned. Do you have any position on these situations?
Right. So let me do the Medicaid one first. In our opinion, the Medicaid funding comes from an advanced – that reserve comes from an enhanced match rate from a particular slice of the Medicaid program. We actually did earn that. That is actually state money. And the reason is when we built the budget, we did not account for – that funding to be in the budget year after year. And so it just kept going into this reserve fund. So that is actually our money.
Does the federal government agree with you there?
Yes. And the issue is the funding has never been secure. So it was an enhanced match rate. And so every year
– enhanced match rate meaning
– meaning above and beyond what you would consider a normal match rate. So
and match rate is when the federal government matches what the state
right.
can –
So
can,
for instance, say you have 50% state fund and 50% federal funding. This is a population that actually draws above the 50%. We never detracted the 50% state funding, and so this enhanced amount went into this reserve. In fiscal year 17, 18, and 19, we will budget it in the budget. The reason we haven't done that is because it's been kind of living year to year. At this point, we know it'll reoccur at least for the next three fiscal years, including the current one. When we get to fiscal year 19 and we look into 20, then I think we have a we'll have to see whether or not it's been reaffirmed by Congress. And so that's why that funding predominantly built up. There's a bunch of other reasons that are much smaller than that, but that is actually money that we earn that's ours. And it walks and talks like state money, so we could rematch it, so on and so forth. In terms of the Vermont Health Connect, I am less familiar with that. I do not believe, however, it's our position that that money needs to be repaid. I understand what the Inspector General said, but I think that we have a counter opinion to that, and I think that needs to be fleshed out a bit more before we get to the point where we're sending $10 million back to the feds for that, because I think there is a difference of opinion and there's some collaborative information on our side that they may not have access to. So that has to be fleshed out a bit more.
All right. Well, keep us posted on that. We'll follow up on that. We're talking today about the federal money that flows into the state of Vermont from Washington every year. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about how the state continue to look at how the state plans its budget around that, but also what might be at risk. We have more questions from you. And what happens, you know, how does it work out that our representatives in Washington can get more money to the state? How does that work? We're going to look at that question as well. Our number, 1-800 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your notes on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're taking a look at all the federal money that comes into the state of Vermont and where it goes with Finance Commissioner Andy Pulido. We're also seeing if there's any sense of how federal money to the states might shift and what contingencies Vermont has if we get less money than anticipated. If you want to ask a question, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Mark says, what happens to Vermont when all the seniority and clout of our federal congressional delegation retires or dies? With all their experience in D.C. and ability to pull down federal dollars to Vermont, Leahy, Sanders, and Welch are crucial to the ability of Vermont to fund the programs and provide services many are dependent on and have grown accustomed to. None of these three men are spring chickens anymore. Now, Commissioner Pulido, I won't ask you to comment on their ages, but what about that idea of seniority in Washington and how representatives in Washington are able to pull extra funds to their state?
Right. I can tell you from experience that our delegation, in my opinion, is probably one of the best in the country. They are very good, they and their staff, at alerting us when there are opportunities to apply for grants. So there's a couple of ways that we get notified. There's journals that come out to all of the leadership in the state that identify granting opportunities. And, you know, there's a regular old Medicaid, right? So we know that's a – but the one-off grants that I mentioned earlier, our delegation is very good at knowing who's in state government, who they need to contact. And I can tell you in all three of those cases – I get calls on a fairly regular basis saying, hey, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? Less so in this current role because the Commissioner of Finance doesn't really apply for federal grants. But in a programmatic role like at AHS or ANR or AG, there's a pretty close working relationship between the delegation and the heads of each of those organizations. And I think, as somebody who's been in the system for a long time, I think that that concern is real. It'd be better to see, you know, if the delegation change slowly as opposed to all at one time. But we don't know how that's going to shape up. I can say in particular in my former role with Senator Leahy on the Judiciary Committee, he was key in working to get grants targeted at segments of the population that helped us do what we did. So all the success we had in corrections and driving the populations down and saving all the money we did, Senator Leahy was a huge part of that.
Now, you say the delegation is great in looking at granting opportunities. Other people might say, look, this is pork barrel spending, maybe not on corrections, but, you know, that states getting money for projects, this is additional spending by the federal government, which is eventually, you know, when you get to where the source is, all of us spending money for right. then projects that different states can pull down, you know, that's again, not everybody thinks this is a great thing when a state can get extra money from its
right.
delegation.
I would say Vermont is a very rural state, right? So we have a big land area with most of the population in a couple of geographic areas, and the rest of the state's pretty well spread out. Finding a state tax base that will pay for the infrastructure spread out like Vermont is going to be either very expensive for the taxpayer locally or at least at the federal level. Now, the federal government, we're not sitting there telling them we need, you know, put a grant out for the following. They're the ones who issue grants. We simply go through the application process. I can't speak to states like on the lower end of – I was going to use an example. I'm going to stay away from it. On the lower end of that $1 ratio as to whether or not they actively apply for grants or so on and so forth. I don't know what their mechanisms are. I can tell you in Vermont, we are very good at going after grants and using them pointed at particular sources. And federal money has helped us do a whole host of things. So I'm not going to dismiss that and say it's completely untrue. But for the most part, federal grants help us to do a lot of the things in Vermont that have been creative and innovative. But I'm not going to remark on the individual pieces of that, but that's my opinion anyway.
Let's go to Lisa calling in from Burlington. Hi, Lisa. Go right ahead.
Hi. My question is about sanctuary cities like Burlington, and what you anticipate the impact of Trump's pledge to cut federal funding to those cities will be on our ability to provide for the immigrants and refugees that we are looking to protect.
Lisa, thanks for your call. Commissioner Polito, with the caveat that you're not a lawyer here, you're not speaking to the legal specifications, but as finance commissioner, you must be looking at things coming out of the Trump administration and areas where President Trump says, I'm going to cut funding here. So to Lisa's point about this announcement that he would like to cut funding to sanctuary cities.
So, you know, currently we've looked at this with our legal team, and there's a little bit of a lack of definition on what it even means at this point. In terms of the local individual cities or jurisdictions, I think you'd have to talk to the officials that are in charge. But at the statewide level, the biggest impact would be, I think, to the state police. And it's our opinion that we are in compliance with the law. And so the impact at this point, in our opinion, is zero. But recognizing there's a little bit of a lack of definition on what these orders even mean.
At the risk of eyes glazing over, could you clearly and succinctly explain, you mentioned earlier something called the small state minimum, and small rural states do have a little bit of protection in the system so that when funding goes down, it doesn't go, you know, to zero for small states.
That's right. You ultimately hit a floor. So even all states that are classified as small states, and I think it's population, and it is population based, they go to a floor. So it doesn't make sense to give a state a grant for $22, for instance. So there's a minimum of how much each state gets. And then as you go to the bigger states, you move up from there. So there is a threshold. And we gain a lot from the small state minimum because at some point you lose the population-based calculation and you wind up at a bottom line. That is not a big driver, but it is a partial driver in the federal money we get. So even if a lot of the federal funding was notched back on a per capita basis, you'd still have that small state minimum.
Yeah, we'd get more per capita than a larger state.
That's right. I hope that didn't glaze over too bad.
No, that was all right. You mentioned earlier some of the ways that Vermont has built in a little bit of a contingency and a little bit of a buffer into the state budget so that you can ride out the, you know, variances in federal funding. Are there other things, though, that you are worried about right now that may be at risk that you could delineate for us?
I think Vermont has a strong history of fiscal management. I know we all debate whether or not we get too much federal money or what strong fiscal management means, but we have a fantastic bond rating. We have mandatory or statutory reserves filled. We don't ever have a conversation about deviating from the statutory reserves, so they're funded. And we have optional reserves that we've set up that will protect us in the short term. I think we're in pretty good shape. I'm not particularly worried about what's been talked about. What worries me the most is the federal deficit and using that as a way to take a sledgehammer to federal grants, because that federal deficit is real. And at some point, somehow, that federal deficit needs to be attended to in a real way. And we've remarked about it politically for years, but it's not really moving down in the direction. And that could be used as a lever to come after a lot of the federal money. And that's the piece that worries me the most.
Well, so like what? Specific programs that you think might be targeted?
Or all of them. Or just take a piece off the top of all of them. For instance, get rid of a federal agency just to save money. I understand doing that because that's not – we do things in the state to save money from time to time. But there's a responsible way to cut back on that deficit, and there's an irresponsible way. And how this shapes up over the next few years – I think we'll set the table for what it means to the state. It's very uncertain at this point.
So you are concerned?
A little bit, yeah.
And you think there may be that sledgehammer, as you call it, taken to the federal?
I think at some point we're going to have to tend to the federal deficit.
Well, that is Vermont's Finance Commissioner, Andy Polito. Thank you for explaining a little bit about how federal dollars flow into Vermont. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
Coming up, with the refugee resettlement in a state of flux, we'll get an update on where things stand in the state from VPR's Patty Daniels, who met this morning with the director of the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program. That's coming up next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. VPR has been following the developing story of refugee resettlement and the impact in Vermont of President Trump's policy change late last week. Vermont Edition executive producer Patty Daniels joins us now for an update on work that has halted and work that continues with refugees in Vermont. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jane.
Can you recap the policy change that has caused this disruption in all areas of immigration?
Yeah, just briefly what everyone has been reading about. There are seven countries on a list from which no immigration is going to be allowed. That includes Syria, which then directly affects the Syrian refugees that were planned to come to Vermont. In addition to that, no refugee resettlement will happen for 120 days. So we do have an indefinite ban on Syrian refugees coming to the United States, including Vermont. And after that 120 days, it's hard to know what changes there will be. But if that list of seven banned countries stays in effect, then that at least answers that part of the question.
Okay, so looking more specifically at Rutland, what happens to Rutland?
Right. So Vermont Refugee Resettlement opened an office in Rutland and hired staff there in anticipation of needing to support 100 people who would be resettled. And now they have only nine resettled refugees needing that support. And Rutland Mayor Christopher Loris suggested last week that refugee resettlement work in Rutland would just have to close down. It's easy to understand why Vermont Refugee Resettlement Project might need to close that Rutland office. But when I talked with Emila Mirjanovic, the executive director of VRRP this morning, she told me that they are planning to keep that office open. They have government contracts to provide these services. They have commitments to fulfill in the community.
Okay, so she says they're going to keep that office open, but there's no chance they'll just move those families up to Burlington, Patty, where there is already an office and support systems in place?
Right. I know. I asked that specifically, and Mirjanovic says these two families will stay in Rutland as planned.
How are these families doing?
She told me that they stayed with host families for their first week in Rutland, but then just over this weekend, they moved into their own apartments. There were a lot of volunteer effort that had been marshaled to make that possible. Between the two families, there are three school-aged children, and they have just started going to school. And now the focus is lining up employment for the parents.
Patty, there have been news reports that some refugees will actually be allowed into the United States just this week, despite what you were telling us earlier about, you know, the ban and what we've heard about the ban on refugees coming in for now, the temporary ban. Is there any chance that Vermont might still receive a few more refugees from either from Syria or elsewhere?
It's true there are some more refugees coming to the United States, but no, none are coming to Vermont. I spoke with Eskander Nagash. He's the senior vice president of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigration in Washington. And he told me there are exceptions being made this week, and that will allow 872 refugees into the United States up until tomorrow, February 2nd. These are people who were already in that so-called pipeline. They had already been cleared, and they were stopped from traveling because of the policy change last week. So all of these individuals are from countries that are not on the banned list, but none of them are coming to Vermont. Nagash did tell me that there was one case of a Somali refugee who had been cleared for resettlement in Vermont. He was supposed to arrive next week, and his flight has been canceled because Somalia is, of course, one of those seven countries.
So even those who had been cleared, if they're in the from those seven countries on that list of banned countries, they are not coming.
That's right.
Can you back up just a second and explain what the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigration is and does?
Yeah, right. So there's a lot of acronyms in the world of refugee resettlement. There are nine non-governmental agencies in the U.S. that oversee all refugee resettlement, and the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigration, USCRI, is one of those nine. In news reporting, you have probably heard the names of other groups. Many of them are faith-based, but they all basically do the same work, which is to receive the refugees that the U.S. Department of State has selected for resettlement here. And those nine agencies, they oversee all of the local refugee resettlement programs around the country. USCRI oversees resettlement in 35 communities, 35 places around the country, and that includes the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Project.
Okay, so coming back to Vermont now, are there other refugees who were supposed to come to Vermont who now aren't?
Yes. Mirjanovic from Vermont Refugee Resettlement Project told me this morning that several families were scheduled to arrive next week in Vermont, up to 15 people, most of them from Bhutan, and they are not traveling. She also told me about a Somali family. Part of the family is already here. They have already been resettled in Vermont, and they had been waiting, I think she said, for 3 years for a family reunification visa to come through for their relatives. She said that visa had just been approved, but Somalia is on that banned list. So those individuals cannot travel. That reunification won't be taking place. So the way Mirjanovic described this to me is that the mother of this family is in a really kind of painful place where her relatives cannot come here. And she is afraid that if she leaves here, even just to visit with them, that she won't be allowed back into the United States. So it's just, you know, another one of those ripple effects, those ramifications that we've been hearing about all week of individual families in Vermont that are seeing this policy play out in their lives.
Well, so what does the VRRP, the Refugee Resettlement Program, do now that there's this ban on all refugees?
Right. So they do have work that continues, and that is with the people who have recently arrived. They've actually, Vermont has received 185 refugees since October. And, you know, we have spent so much time and attention talking about Syrian refugee resettlement, but most of those refugees came from, they are Bhutanese who came from Nepal, Congolese, Somali, Iraqi, and also those two Syrian families. So the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Project office in Colchester continues to provide services to all of those people who have recently arrived. There are language classes and social services, citizenship classes, job counseling. They have, you know, storerooms of household goods and clothing to help ease transition, and winter clothing for families that aren't used to winter. You know, just sitting in their office this morning, Jane, there were a half a dozen people from really different backgrounds who came in for appointments with caseworkers or men, women, children. So there is a lot of activity that still continues for the Refugee Resettlement Program, even as new individuals aren't actually arriving right now.
And with all of this political flux, what does happen next? What do we know?
Yeah, it is fluid. That's the word that everyone keeps using, right? This week, the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Project is organizing meetings with different refugee communities in Vermont that it serves. So Bhutanese, Somalis, Congolese, just to review their legal status with them and to reassure them of rights that they have as legally resettled refugees here. I peppered Mirjanovic with all kinds of hypothetical situations, but there just really isn't much more than she can say than I guess that's possible. she has marked the 120-day ban on refugees as ending on May 27th. And at that point, we should know more if the Trump administration has been able to redesign the refugee admissions process to fit its definition of extreme vetting. But in any case, if and when refugee admissions are restarted, the executive order states that the U.S. will accept less than half the number of refugees than previously targeted. That means about 50,000 people will be admitted, presumably none of them from the countries on the banned list.
That's VPR's Patty Daniels, the Vermont Edition executive producer. And Patty, before we let you go, you have one other thing that you wanted to have us hear today.
Yeah, that's right. So about 2 weeks ago, I recorded an interview with the U.S. State Department's Director of Refugee Admissions, Larry Bartlett. He works with population, migration, and refugees. And he explained in that interview the entire involved process of vetting refugees before they are admitted to the United States. It is a detailed process. At the end of the interview, almost as an aside, Bartlett asked if he could just make a statement in defense of refugee resettlement. Again, this was recorded on January 10th, and this is what he said.
I'll try to be diplomatic. It's really terrible to be a refugee. You know, it's really terrible to have had to leave your country. And I think one of the things that Americans don't always understand, and I won't single out Americans because I think it's people around the world don't understand who aren't refugees, who have it pretty good. These aren't people who want to come to the United States. These aren't people who've left Syria because they want to come to the U.S. and make a better life. Those are economic migrants. That's different. These are people who've left everything they've had. They've, first of all, had many of them have had you know, tragedies within their family, people killed and tortured. And they've been surviving. And, you know, the one thing that, you know, one of the words that is often used with refugees or about refugees is that they're very resilient. You know, these are people who fled. These are people who had the wherewithal to get out. They were able to do it. Sometimes they had to bribe their way through borders. They've coped. Surviving, you know, survival as a refugee in a place like Jordan or Turkey is not easy. There's survival sex that happens. There's kids working. And there's all kinds of bad things that people do to cope. And they've made that decision in order to stay alive, in order to provide for my family while I'm treading water. This is what I've got to do. And so to me, you know, one of the greatest things about our program is that we're giving people a second chance. And, you know, by and large, they make an amazing opportunity for it. And, you know, I would hope that every refugee who comes here as an adult has an amazing life. We know that it's hard. It's hard to learn a new language the older you get. It's harder to make a transition into a different job when you come out of a different cultural environment. But one thing that you will always find with refugees is oftentimes they will say, it's about my kids. And it's to me, it's the one thing that unites us all. It's about our kids. It's about the next generation. It's about people who are less fortunate than we are. And I just think this is an amazing program. And I really thank the people of Rutland for opening their homes and their hearts to refugees.
That's Larry Bartlett. He's the Director of Refugee Admissions for the U.S. Department of State. He made those remarks on January 10th, before the changeover of presidential administrations when a different refugee policy was in place. I mentioned that he spoke with VPR about the detailed process that was used to vet refugees. We have posted a video produced by NPR that explains how that process has worked. You'll find it on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And finally today, a few more questions and answers about the state's new vehicle inspection program that's due to go into place in March. After our program last week with DMV Commissioner Robert Ide, we got a couple of specific questions that hadn't been answered. We put those questions to Commissioner Ide, and he answered. Producer Sam Gale Rosen is here to help read some of those. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Jane. We had several questions regarding the data collected by the system and privacy issues. David asked, what privacy policies do you have? After gathering all my information, am I going to have telemarketers calling me trying to sell me an extended warranty because they've sold my information and mileage? Mark wrote in, suppose they share the mileage data with insurance companies and they charge you a surcharge on your policy if you drive over, say, 12,000 miles a year. And we got this question from Jessica. I'd like to know what data will be collected and stored by the new system, how long it will be stored for, who it is accessible to, and how secure that data is.
And these questions are coming up because this is a new digital system that will store this information and be searchable to people, for example, buying a used car who want to know what the inspection history is of this car. So Robert Ide, the commissioner of the DMV, responded with this. The data that is collected is stored in the database that the vendor is responsible for maintaining and hosting. The data will be stored for the life of the contract and can then be migrated to a new system should the state desire. There is no consumer information stored by this system. Everything is keyed off the VIN number of the vehicle.
We also got this question from Kevin. I brought my car into my mechanic, who doesn't perform inspections, with instructions to go over anything that might keep me from passing inspection. We made several repairs, and I brought the car in to get inspected. The inspector said I needed $2,200 worth of repairs. I told him not to touch the car and brought it to another inspector, and the car passed without repair. This system will make getting second opinions impossible and encourage gouging by less reputable mechanics.
Well, Commissioner Ide responds, this system does not make it harder for customers to get a second opinion. In your case, when your first inspector completed your inspection, he would have had to either take a picture or make a note of what he was indicating was wrong with your vehicle. This is under the new system. And then call you, and you'll have the same ability to tell him not to make the repairs. When you took it to the second shop, that inspector would see the comments and photos and make his own decision and document why, in fact, he was passing the car with comments and photos as he deems appropriate. In this case, the state will have evidence that the first garage might be engaging in less than honest business practices, and our inspectors can follow up on that.
And finally, Cannie wrote with a question about the $2.21 that will be added to the price of an inspection to go directly to the company managing the digital system. Cannie writes, so how many cars get inspected each year? Because at $2 plus, it seems like this vendor will be making a lot of money. The Vermont population is slightly over 600,000. If only a quarter of those have a vehicle at $200,000, then that's $400,000 per year to this vendor. That seems like a lot to pay the vendor. And Chris says, the commissioner mentioned that the way the vendor is getting paid is by a $2.21 fee or inspection. Is that fee going to be forever or just until they're paid off?
Well, the commissioner says fees paid to the vendor cover the design, development, hosting, including disaster recovery and business continuity to meet the levels required in the contract, support, maintenance, equipment deployment, software enhancements, and technical support. Thanks to Commissioner Ide for answering those questions. You can send your questions to us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Thanks, Sam. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, we're joined by Congressman Peter Welch. We'll talk about his reactions to the first days of the Trump administration and the president's controversial executive actions. We'll also ask Congressman Welch about his priorities going forward. Send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen live to our interview with Representative Welch tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.